If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today, you'll hear Seth's interview with acclaimed author Mohsin Hamid, who sticks around for a few more questions backstage. But first, here's a closer look.
One thing that's become clear over the past week is that lying is now such a central feature of the Trump administration that many in D.C. just take it for granted. But there's one issue where Trump's lies could have very real consequences for millions of people, and that's health care. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. One thing that happens when you make as many wild, unproven claims as Trump does is that the people around you have to go to increasingly ridiculous lengths to try to defend those claims. And this weekend, we saw another example of that when White House counselor Kellyanne Conway was asked if she had any proof for Trump's outlandish claim that Obama wiretapped him during the campaign and offered this bizarre answer.
Do you know whether Trump Tower was wiretapped?
What I can say is there are many ways to surveil each other now, unfortunately.
Do you believe
There was an article this week that talked about how you can surveil someone through their phones, through their, certainly through their television sets, any number of different ways, and microwaves that turn into cameras, et cetera.
If Trump had a secret camera in his microwave, that must have been a very distressing feed to watch.
How long does it take to warm up KFC, Melania? Melania?
Put a camera in his microwave.
You sure you don't want to just wiretap his phones? No?
We'll put a little secret camera right there in the back of his microwave. Keep an eye on him.
Today, Conway did the rounds on the morning shows and tried to clarify her remarks by claiming she was answering a question about surveillance in general, not Trump's wiretapping allegations.
The fact that
he didn't ask about it generally, though, that's just true in the transcript. You may have answered it generally, but you were asked specifically.
Chris, I'm not Inspector Gadget. I don't believe people are using the microwave to spy on the Trump campaign.
And when Inspector Gadget heard that, he said, "Even I think you're crazy, and my hat turns into a helicopter." Now, Republicans may try to move past Trump's wiretapping claims, but there's one issue where they won't be able to avoid the consequences of Trump's lies, and that's health care. As a candidate, Trump claimed repeatedly that he had a great health care plan that would be easy to implement. But as president, he discovered that things aren't quite so simple.
You're going to have such great health care at a tiny fraction of the cost, and it's going to be so easy.
Now, I have to tell you, it's an unbelievably complex subject. Nobody knew that health care could be so complicated.
In his defense, when this guy is your doctor, you'd have to assume health care is pretty easy. Yeah, dude, I got fired from the laser tag place, so I'm a doctor now. However, I do think some people knew health care was complicated. In fact, watch the reaction of one of those people, Bernie Sanders, when he was asked about Trump's comments on CNN.
I'm wondering when you heard the president today saying, quote, "Nobody knew that healthcare could be so complicated."
Bernie Sanders hasn't laughed that hard since he used to babysit Charlie Chaplin. And remember, you're only a little tramp because of the millionaires and the billionaires. In fact, Trump seemed so befuddled by health care that even after the plan was released last week, he talked about it in ways that made it seem like he had no idea what was actually in it.
This will be a plan where you can choose your doctor. This will be a plan where you can choose your plan. And you know what the plan is? This is the plan.
You know what the plan is? This is the plan. Basically, Trump's take on health care is an Abbott and Costello routine. What's the plan? The plan is the plan. Will I still be insured? Third base. So because Trump made promises he had no intention of keeping, and because he doesn't even seem to understand the basics of how healthcare policy works, he essentially deferred to GOP leaders, specifically House Speaker Paul Ryan, to put together a plan, despite telling voters he would be different from Republicans like Ryan. In fact, Trump is now so supportive of Ryan's healthcare plan, despite the fact that it breaks so many of Trump's own promises, that he's pulling out all the stops to convince skeptical members of Congress to get on board.
Also a big test for President Trump, who's going to be wooing some key members of Congress next week. He's inviting them to the White House for an exclusive pizza and bowling party to see if he can convince them.
That's right. Trump is trying to sway members of Congress with an 8-year-old's birthday party.
Also, good news, Steve Bannon has agreed to be a terrifying clown.
So, it turns out that voters who thought they were getting a different kind of Republican are, in fact, getting the same old failed GOP policies that Trump claimed to be against. And central to this GOP philosophy is the idea that health care is not a right, but a commodity that you can only access if you can afford it. A philosophy summed up by this now infamous comment from Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz last week.
Americans have choices, and they've got to make a choice. And so maybe rather than getting that new iPhone that they just love and they want to go spend hundreds of dollars on that, maybe they should invest it in their own health care.
Yeah, Americans need to cool it with the gadgets. They always want the hot new iPhone or pacemaker or crutches when a good old stick will do. But Chaffetz isn't the only Republican to frame health care as a commodity rather than a right. Ted Cruz, for example, said something similar in a debate over health care policy with Bernie Sanders on CNN a few weeks ago when talking about the Obamacare mandate.
Imagine if the federal government mandated that everyone in America must drive a Lamborghini. Now, I've never driven a Lamborghini. I mean, they look kind of fun. But you know what? I'm willing to bet most of us, if that was the mandate, and it'd be cool, you say leather seats, you could go, I don't know, 200 miles an hour.
Okay, well, that's a analogy, because healthcare treats all illnesses, whereas a Lamborghini only treats erectile dysfunction. Well, today, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that the GOP healthcare plan would cause 24 million Americans to lose coverage. And yet, despite that, GOP leaders are rushing the bill through the House as quickly as possible. They held two marathon overnight committee hearings with no public input. One lasted 27 hours and another lasted 18 hours and ended at 4:30 in the morning. In fact, there's been so little public input into this whole process that when one GOP congressman was asked the basic question of how many public hearings the House has held on the bill, he could not answer.
How many hearings, open hearings with the witness testimony and the like, have you had on this bill?
We've had a series of hearings over the last several years.
No, in this Congress, though, how many hearings in this Congress on this bill?
We have gone to the American people with Paul Ryan's Better Way.
How many hearings has your committee had on this bill?
We had a 27-hour marathon session.
How many hearings has your committee had on this bill?
We've had a series of hearings over the last several years.
You know, I'm surprised he didn't just take a cue from Trump and lie. We've had 1.5 million hearings, one for each person who came to the inauguration. Of course, if you actually saw what Republicans were doing in these hearings, you might understand why they're holding them in the middle of the night when people aren't watching. Just take Missouri GOP Congressman Jason Smith, who argued that Obamacare's taxes on tanning beds should be repealed, using a very dumb analogy.
You could tax a lot of different items if you want to stop behavior. You know, I love ice cream. Ice cream is probably not the most healthy thing to eat. Why is there not a tax on that? You know what? If you look at the number one cause of skin cancer, it's not tanning beds. Do a Google search. It's the sun. So why have they not proposed a tax on the sun?
Yeah. Why don't they tax the sun? Is it because we already know that an orange ball of gas would never pay its taxes? All right. Even more embarrassing, though, is the fact that Republicans and Democrats then proceeded to actually spend time debating whether it was possible to tax the sun.
To relate ice cream to tanning is a serious mistake. There's a major difference in the impact.
Why did you not look at a sun tax? Because that's the number one cause of skin cancer.
I'll tell you why. Because it's a little hard to tax the sun. It's much.
Spain taxes the sun.
No. Well.
Spain taxes the sun, so I'm just curious.
I'm not sure how they tax the sun.
I'll send you an article.
Look. You can't tax the sun. Take it from a guy who was there when the sun was formed. The guy who was the sun's college roommate. But congressional Republicans didn't only focus their ire on the tanning tax. Another GOP congressman took issue with Obamacare's requirements that insurers cover certain basic medical procedures, like prenatal care for pregnant women. His main objection, why shouldn't men have to pay for it?
What mandate in the Obamacare bill does he take issue with? I'm curious, what is it we're mandating?
Would the gentleman yield?
Yeah, sure.
What about men having to purchase prenatal care? Is that not correct?
Reclaiming my time.
And should they?
Yeah, why should men pay for prenatal care? For that matter, why should women? Prenatal care is for the fetuses. Fetuses should pay for it. They'll just have to give up their precious iPhones. All of this, of course, has put the bill in a very precarious position. Everyone from doctors to hospitals to insurers to the AARP have come out against it. In fact, as CNN reported, it's so toxic that nobody wants their name on the Republican health care bill. And the White House says don't call it Trump care. Even Donald Trump won't put his name on this thing. And one reason for that might be that he's worried people won't like it as much as Obamacare. In fact, today, Trump blamed the media for Obamacare's rising popularity in the polls.
The press is making Obamacare look so good all of a sudden. I'm watching the news. Looks so good. The press is making it look so wonderful, so that if we end it, everyone's going to say, oh, remember how great Obamacare used to be. Remember how wonderful it used to be. It was so great. It's a little bit like President Obama. When he left, people liked him. When he was here, people didn't like him so much.
I love how Donald Trump can't figure out why Obama is suddenly so popular. It's you, dude. It's you. I mean, Trump's like the guy who clears out the subway car because he f***ed his pants and then says, oh, I guess that was everyone's stop. This has been A Closer Look.
Hey, I'm Amber Ruffin.
And I'm Jenny Hagel. Thank you so much for listening to the Late Night with Seth Meyers podcast.
But just one more thing. If you could, please subscribe and rate our podcast.
And review it.
And review it. And then call us and tell us you like us in person. Thank you so much.
Our guest, the best-selling author, whose fantastic new novel, Exit West, is available now. Please welcome to the show, Mohsin Hamid. How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
So, you live in Pakistan.
Yes.
You travel the world to promote your books.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of your writing. Do you find that different places receive your writing in different ways?
Different people receive writing in different ways. So, I like to tell a story about this guy in Washington, D.C., an American guy, blonde hair, blue eyes, comes up after a reading of The Reluctant Fundamentalist and says, you know, this novel's about me. And Dr. Fundamentalist is about a Pakistani guy who grows a beard and goes back to Pakistan after working in New York City.
Yeah.
So I looked at him, I looked at the book in his hands, and it was my book, and I said, you know, how so? And he said, well, I went to an Ivy League school, I worked on Wall Street, and I quit my job, and I'm a yoga instructor. And that's when I actually realized that Dr. Fundamentalist is actually the story of a liberal arts kid who goes to work
right.
and stops working. And so, yeah, people react in different ways. You can't predict.
Yeah, I still would rather read your version than his. Yeah. So this is interesting. This is about a refugee couple in an unnamed country who sort of escaping their country and traveling around trying to find a home. And there's a great amount of realism to it. The character is very real. The dialogue is real. And yet there's this one element, which is the way they go from one country to the other is through sort of magical doors. I feel like that might be the best description of it, yeah?
Yeah, that's correct.
And so what brought you to use this element of sort of fairy tale into this very real story?
Well, partly I think the doors sort of already exist. Like, I was in Pakistan. I feel like I've sort of stepped through a magical door to arrive sitting next to you. Distance has collapsed in our world. So we are pressed close up against each other through technology. But I wanted to focus on what happens before you move. You know, what leads someone to leave where they live? What's the enormous sorrow or pain? And then what happens when you get there, which is most of your life? Crossing the Rio Grande or crossing the Mediterranean is a tiny little piece of that story. The real story is all of us experience this pain before we move and then something that happens afterwards.
And I think that most of us do see it only in that snapshot of the journey. I think when we think of refugees, we do think of people crammed onto a boat or people trying to cross a border. And it seems like it mattered deeply to you to make these very realistic, bring humanity to these characters.
Yeah, because it's to see ourselves in these characters. So, say the Nadia, the characters in this novel, are two young people having a love affair. They've just met. They go to Chinese restaurants, they hang out, and suddenly their city starts to fall apart. Things get interrupted. People who move are people just like us. It's the part where they move that's different. But before that and after that, they're people exactly like us.
Do you feel like that is the element that's missing in the conversation about the travel ban?
Well, I think there are lots of elements missing, but, part of it is, it's great. It's a great idea with a couple of small flaws. one part of it is that it's based on a hysterical level of fear. I live in Pakistan, and things are sometimes a little bit scary, and, you know, part of how you deal with that in life is you've got to be a little bit brave and just live your life. And what's happened now is we've been made so frightened of people, and we think that in the travel ban is an example of that, where let's just take a whole bunch of people and treat them as though they're all this horrible, frightening thing, and in the process throw away our commitment to equality and human decency.
What is the conversation in Pakistan like amongst your friends and family about the travel ban and about America in general right now, as someone who sort of will spend time in both places?
I mean, for people like me, it's a sense of heartbreak, right? So if you're part Pakistani, I've lived 17 years in the U.S., the idea of not being able to come is really heartbreaking. But my daughter, Dina, is 7 years old, and my wife and I brought her to New York in August for a month, and she went back saying, I love New York, I love America, why, you know, let's go live there, it's fantastic. And just now, she, you know, told me before I got on a plane to come this way, you know, don't go. And she said, you know, there's a new president there, and his name is Donald Trump, and he hates Muslims, and what if he locks you up? And kids in her school are talking about this. They're actually frightened, little seven-year-old kids all over the planet. That can't be a good thing. Like, that's not really what America wants to stand for.
No. When she told you that there was a guy named Donald Trump who was president, did you say, I know that?
She loves Hillary, too, by the way, my daughter. She loves Hillary, interestingly enough.
Oh, well, there you go. How important do you think storytelling and, being a storyteller is going forward in the times we live?
It's really important. The reason why we have storytelling is because we don't want to be bound, you know, as human beings, by what was and what is. Like, we have to imagine what could be. And right now, there's this nostalgic political force where we're looking back, you know, make America great again, and the caliphate of the 8th century, that's where we want to be. We have to imagine new futures, and I think what storytellers can do is begin to imagine new ways of being and new places that we can all go to.
Well, thank you so much for continuing to tell your stories. This is a fantastic book. Thank you for making the time and being
thank
here.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mohsen Hamid, everybody. Exit West is available now.
Hey, everybody. This is Henry. I'm here with Mohsen Hamid, the author of Exit West, a fantastic new novel. I wanted to ask you, Mohsen, you're a novelist now, but you were studying law when you were younger. How did you make the transition from law to novelist?
Well, about 2 weeks into law school, I realized that I'd probably made a terrible mistake. And then I stuck
it's
around.
It's an expensive mistake.
Yeah, it was an expensive mistake. The loans were starting to accrue. I never thought I could make a living writing books, so I needed a job. But I soon discovered that law wasn't for me. Afterwards, though, I realized more and more that what I learned in law school was very helpful because the law is about words, and one word different changes everything. And the Constitution is a kind of fictional creation. You imagine this future, these rules we all play by. And so, weirdly enough, I now think being a novelist and studying the law aren't that far apart.
That's interesting. And you've also done pretty well as a novelist. You've had many bestsellers, which is fantastic. I also wanted to ask, when you were an undergrad, you had some incredible teachers. Can you tell us about who you learned from when you were younger?
I studied with Joyce Carol Oates and Toni Morrison, and it was an incredible experience. I was at Princeton, and they taught creative writing courses, and I applied for them and started writing with them. And I'd never really thought I could be a writer. In a strange way, studying with writers like that, having them read my work, was the first time I sort of really believed I could do it. And I think it's incredibly important. It's, you know, you have to imagine sort of your own story of how you can be a hero in your own life, basically. And it takes sometimes your own heroes intervening to make that happen.
As a young writer, how intimidating was it writing for these literary legends?
Weirdly, I think much less than it would be today. I mean, one of the nice things about being young is that you know absolutely nothing, but think that you know so much. I was like, of course Toni Morrison's teaching me. But later I thought, you know, my goodness, you read this like totally horrible stuff that I was writing.
I also wanted to ask you this question. I always like asking authors, do you like talking about your writing?
Yeah, I do, I guess. It sort of depends. It depends on the conversation. But most of the time, I'm sitting in a room by myself for several years. So if you yank me out of that hole and put me in front of an actual human being who wants to talk about my work, it's a nice change.
Yeah, and you've also said that it takes you a long time to write books, but you write actually pretty short books.
Yeah, I'd rather somebody reads my book twice than just halfway. I write these short books in part because I guess I live in Lahore, where in Pakistan, where lots of people don't read literary fiction, and small books seem more accessible. But also because I think it's sort of nice to read a novel in one day if you can. And I write novels that are of a size where if you start in the morning, you can finish the afternoon, or you start in the afternoon, you finish that evening.
I read read Exit West in one day.
Fantastic!
I think it's fantastic. Thank you so much for being here. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.